Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brooke, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today is October 27, 2011. Thank you to all our listeners. We have reached way over 25,000 listens this week, and the number of listeners keeps growing. We've got a bunch of shows going on. On Monday evening at 8 o'clock, Grant Bentley talks about facial analysis and homeopathy. On Wednesday at noon, Dr. Adil Kasim of India, MD homeopath and cardiologist, talks to us about keeping our heart healthy. We've recently spoken about hypertension and heart failure. On Thursday, we've got this show, Vaccination and Your Rights in the United States, with a lot of current events going on right now. And following the show today at 1 o'clock will be Dr. Christina Chambreau, veterinarian and homeopath, talking today also about vaccinations. And she's been telling us how to keep our pets healthy. On Sunday evening, not regularly, but as often as possible, we do a meditation for healing and spiritual health. And for those who are new to Blog Talk Radio, you'll find a chat right below the announcement on the page of the Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community. We welcome your questions and comments. Those folks who have identified themselves and call in, we're welcoming your calls. And please do share these shows on Twitter, Facebook, and all the other share buttons. You may download the archives to your computer, iTunes, iPod, cell phone, or other mobile device for convenient listening. And I understand that many people listen over and over to a number of the shows to catch all the information and really let it sink in. And maybe they'd do a blog about it. That would be awesome. So here we are with Alan Phillips, attorney at law, one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. He advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on the subject of vaccine exemption and waiver rights. And we also talk about our constitutional rights. He does so many things, and he's on a number of radio shows and even television. So we welcome him today, and he's going to get us started on the topic of discussion.
Well, good afternoon, Debbie, and congratulations again on all the incredible work you're doing with Homeopathy World Community and all these different shows. It's a real pleasure and honor to be a part of that. I thought I'd make a real quick comment since you mentioned that the following show is going to talk about pets and vaccines. There are, in my experience, are very few short answer questions about exemption and waiver rights because there are often those kinds of questions are often multifaceted questions. But I will say, when people ask about exemptions for pets, it's a fairly short answer to the extent that I know the answer. And that is just in general, as much as pets are members of families for those of us that have them and near and dear to our hearts, under the law, animals are generally considered to be property. And so the typical exemptions that apply to human beings do not apply to pets, unfortunately. However, to my pleasant surprise, I came across information recently that there are a handful of states that do have exemptions, medical exemptions for dogs, I believe, if not maybe limited to dogs, but possibly pets beyond that. So you do need to look, as you do with exemption and waiver laws and vaccine mandate laws for humans, you do need to look at it on a state-by-state basis to see exactly what the law is. But again, to my pleasant surprise, discovered that there are some very limited medical exemptions for at least some pets in some states. So maybe something to look into.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to what Christina has to teach us, and I'm sure it'll be more about what she's experienced and how she looks at what are the results of vaccinations and such. So I know you gave me a whole list of items in current events today, and you're going to make a selection for one that you feel is most important to talk about.
Well, there really, of the list I gave you and looking over that again myself this morning, there really are a couple of issues that stand out to me as being of fundamental importance in among the many recent events. And the first one is that an article from ABC News that informs us that a CDC panel has voted to extend HPV vaccine recommendations to young boys. HPV being, I believe, primarily the Gardasil vaccine here in the U.S., and Cervarix maybe as well. But vaccines, at least originally promoted as preventing cervical cancer or reducing cervical cancer rates, and targeting initially primarily young women.
I'm sorry. I opened a website, and of course there's sound going on.
Not a problem, but I did wonder where I was coming from for a moment there.
Okay.
But now the CDC is recommending that boys, young boys, be vaccinated with the HPV vaccine as well, claiming that it protects against at least three different strains. Two or three different strains of the HPV vaccine. There are many different strains. And that this would provide protection against several different kinds of cancers in both men and women. There are a number of concerns that this raises, but I thought if we could, Debbie, I would take a few minutes to read some information about some research that was conducted by the mother of a Gardasil victim, a woman whose teenage daughter died as a consequence of an adverse reaction to the Gardasil vaccine. And it's such a sensitive issue and compelling issue, and the Gardasil vaccine is particularly unique in terms of the questions raised by it and the promotion and aggressive promotion and marketing of this vaccine internationally, and the way other countries have responded to it differently than we have here in the U.S. So I sent you a late email, and I don't know if you had time to get to that, but I thought, with your permission, Debbie, I would go over just some of these points because they're really, I found them quite compelling.
Okay.
This is a letter from, again, a woman whose daughter died in a Gardasil vaccine reaction. This is a letter she wrote to school board members here in my county, Orange County, North Carolina. She wrote to the Chapel Hill-Carborough City Schools School Board last spring in response to an issue that we talked about here on the show a few months ago, where the local school system had a contest for adolescent students. If they got one or more of three recommended vaccines, they could get entered into a contest to win an iPod or a laptop. And the while this was a local contest, it got reaction from around the country and even internationally to some extent, of people who were in the alternative vaccine community who are outraged about that contest. So here are some points then, and Gardasil was one of the vaccines being recommended. This mother says, there is no evidence that the HPV vaccine, Gardasil, will prevent cervical cancer. Gardasil has limited use as an HPV vaccine, but not a vaccine directly for cervical cancer. And in August of 2010, the Director General of the French Agency for Safety of Health Products investigated Merck's claims and found them to be unproven as to the Gardasil vaccine. The claims that it would prevent cervical cancer are unsupported by any studies, and the French, in response to that, have forbidden Gardasil ads in their country. Rather dramatic and direct opposition to what the aggressive marketing that continues in this country. This mother goes on to point out that rates for cervical cancer in developed countries are low, that the American Cancer Society has said that cervical cancer rates dropped by about 75% since regular pap screening procedures were implemented about 40 years ago. And it has been suggested that nearly all cervical cancer can be prevented with just annual pap smears and a non-invasive, inexpensive DNA sequencing test to detect and treat any high-risk HPV types. So the question about whether the vaccination is even necessary at all, really, or much if at all, even from within mainstream medical points of view about vaccinations generally is raised.
This is based on her experience in research. Obviously, she was very passionate about this since she lost her daughter. In her first statement that there's no evidence that the HPV vaccine Gardasil will prevent cervical cancer, so she thinks that that is an unfounded statement, but she says Gardasil has limited use as an HPV vaccine. Okay, so not a vaccine for cervical cancer. Is there a differentiation between the papillomavirus as to try and quell the papillomavirus as opposed to the link between HPV and cervical cancer?
Well, I think one of the problems here is that the connection is maybe somewhat tenuous, but in any event, occurs over a long duration of time. To really know directly whether or not Gardasil can prevent cervical cancer would require a test on the order of decades in length, because we're talking about cancers that actually show up and manifest most typically, as I understand it, decades on down the line, well into adulthood. You would have to follow vaccinated young women for many, many years and a large number of them to have a statistically relevant sample to see what their cancer rates were down the road. And that may be part of the problem with saying that there's really no proof of it at this point. But I think this mother's letter, and she cites every assertion she makes here, and that I'm speaking, she provides a citation for, and I'd be glad to, if anyone would like to see what those sites are, I'd be glad to make those available.
I'll make a download so that I'll make a link onto this web page for the listening audience, and they can receive that information. Okay?
That'll be fine.
All right. So the side effects. So I also had recently written an article, a blog, about the Gardasil HPV cervical and oral and the relationship with oral cancer protection, because one of the reasons that they're promoting that boys have this type of a vaccine starting at age 11 and 12, really, really young, before sexual activity, is because they found out that the vaccine in women will actually initiate the response of a cancer. So that's why, because if they've already got the virus floating in their body, then they're going to be stimulated by it. So that's why they're finding that they have to give this vaccine before sexual activity. And what they're doing is making a prediction that to protect these young boys that who could possibly and potentially get a disorder or a disease, to give them a vaccination. Again, down the line, decades down the line, we don't know what this vaccine will do in the body. And they're jumping over from the experiments or the studies with women to men and making hypotheses that I'm not really sure that they're perfectly confirmed in, also when listening to what this mom has written up about saying that she doesn't think that it's going to be helpful.
Let me just make a note to listeners that the information we're talking about here in terms of the requirement for boys, there are many, many articles out on the web about that, but the particular article that we're drawing some of our information from here in terms of the CDC's decision to recommend HPV vaccine to young boys comes from a list of vaccine-related article links on the Pandemic Response Project website, and that's pandemicresponseproject.com, pandemicresponseproject.com, and there's a news link at the top right on every page, and lots of good articles there that we often draw from in our conversations in this show. But that article is a two-page article, and the second page gets into some of the opposing views. So there is, within the U.S., there are medical experts who have opposing views on the subject. But I think the single, for me as a parent, as a citizen, because I'm not a medical expert, I don't claim any medical expertise, but a lot of what goes on in the alternative vaccine arena is more about politics and corruption and what information is suppressed or not, what decisions are made on complete or incomplete information, those kinds of issues. And those are not medical issues. Those are political issues. Those are information issues. And so when I look at, for example, the French Agency for Safety of Health Products, and they come out and say that Merck's claims of efficacy for the Gardasil vaccine are unproven, and that the claim that it prevents cervical cancer are unsupported by any studies, I'm sure you'll find people at the CDC who, or certainly with Merck, who would disagree with that. But that's a pretty strong statement from an organization like that, and so it's certainly something we should take seriously and say, well, you know, what's going on with that? Let's look a little more closely at this issue. But I think the single biggest concern that I have with vaccines generally, and in particularly with the Gardasil vaccine, has to do with the side effects. And we have in the U.S. an adverse event reporting system designed for vaccine adverse events, and medical doctors are required by federal law to report adverse events. Despite that, there's information from multiple sources that suggests that the vast majority of vaccine adverse events are not reported. There is no penalty that I know of for doctors for not following the federal law that requires them to report adverse events. And I know the National Vaccine Information Center once did a survey of New York pediatricians and found that only 2.5% of the pediatricians polled said that they report vaccine adverse events.
FDA, so we're not getting really all of the numbers in.
Right. We're probably getting the proverbial tip of the iceberg at most. But even with that, when you look at the reported adverse events from Gardasil, they are more than all the other vaccines combined, according to this mother's research. And she has, again, a site for that. And you can look that up on the web at the VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, V-A-E-R-S. Plug that into a search engine, you'll take you right to the page.
And her point for it sort of stands out to me, that when you have a higher number of adverse events compared to the rate of the cervical cancer, then the question again is, who's making the decision that one is more important than the other in terms of protection and life?
Well, we don't even hear in mainstream news that I've ever seen, with very limited exception in the recent Michelle Bachmann controversy over the Gardasil vaccine, but we don't hear much, if anything at all, about adverse events. They tend to be dismissed, either not mentioned at all or immediately and quickly dismissed, or under kind of sweeping statements like, well, the benefits outweigh the risks. The reality is we have no idea what the real benefit-risk ratio is, because the vast majority of adverse events are not reported. So there's just no information available from which anybody can make any reasonable conclusions one way or the other that vaccines, the risk of vaccines is outweighed by the benefits. But if we make that assessment, a preliminary assessment based on the available data, even then we can see that the serious adverse events from the HPV vaccine, from Gardasil, as you point out, is greater than the rate of cervical cancer. And, of course, every case, cervical cancer is certainly not by any means a trivial issue, but I would imagine that not everybody that gets cancer dies from it. Of course, not every serious adverse reaction from a vaccine is a death either. So, sometimes you might, it would be interesting to have compare death rates. And this particular information we have is just comparing serious adverse events with cervical cancer rates. But still, when you consider that the huge unknown about what the actual adverse rates are, and even having potentially the rest of the iceberg not even available, we're just looking at what may very well be the tip of the iceberg, and we still have higher rate of serious adverse events from the vaccine than we have rates of cervical cancer. And you have to ask, of course, at that point, what's your greater risk? You add in some of these other things that we just talked about, that most cervical cancer disappeared with the implementation of PAP screening procedures. And it just really weighs in favor, heavily in favor of not getting the vaccine. And so when you're going to instantly double the prospective market by recommending it to young boys, is it going to have the same high adverse event rate on young boys? Okay, I guess that has yet to be seen.
I think the boys are going to be the guinea pigs of the next era. Well, and also the fact that we're given, I call it a half-truth or misinformation or not any missing information. Her point number five in her letter stating that the respiratory, thoracic, and mediastinal disorders, including pulmonary embolus and seizure-like activity, was missing from the informational literature insert. And that is important information if the person who is having the vaccine does not know what the potential outcomes could be, or adverse event or side effect. And so that's really an important point that she's making there. And that's why she says overall, marketing with deceptive marketing.
Right. And that, of course, then raises the very important question of what is the goal of the people who are designing the literature that's given to consumers or designing the ads. Now, of course, an ad by definition is to sell something. But is it not, and I'm not raising this as a formal legal question, but just sort of on the common sense level, is that deceptive advertising when you promote the use of something, you say it a vaccine, you say it prevents a disease or condition, in this case cancers, and you don't say, and by the way, you might also die or be permanently disabled by the vaccine and, you know, here and these other things, but, you know, you're just sort of leaving that out. You know, to me, as a citizen, as a parent, as a reasonable adult human being, that's just flat out deceptive.
I mean, it's not like, you know, when we listen to our commercials on the television or even on the radio, and the majority of the time is spent with the side effects, including death, including seizure and other types of adverse events to taking any kind of drug. I mean, you think that you're really getting all the information. You know, intellectually, maybe you're hearing it, or maybe you're emotionally dismissing it because you're so bent on wanting to protect yourself or wanting to alleviate some type of discomfort or pain that you're trying to endure. And so it's a combination, you know, because we are getting so many mixed messages, we don't really know what is full disclosure anymore and what is half of the information, because we assume that the FDA and the CDC is monitoring the information and literature that is being produced and disseminated.
We do, and in some cases it may be, although there have been people who have you might call whistleblowers who have stepped out to point out, people from within the FDA itself, to point out that the FDA, its quiet goal is to serve the pharmaceutical industry, even though its purported purpose and claimed purpose for any sort of public purposes is to serve the citizens of the United States. But plenty of evidence to suggest that at times, in fact, they're really not doing that. But back to the Gardasil thing here, it's interesting that the mother's information notes that Gardasil was pulled from the market in India because of illness and death following use of the Gardasil vaccine and unethical marketing practices. And just a quick side note, I probably hammer away at this often in this show, but I just feel like it's a point that really bears underscoring, that it is common and routine for pharmaceutical companies to have criminal and civil fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and Pfizer in 2009 actually had a $1 billion criminal fine, usually for the illegal marketing of drugs. This is an industry that routinely engages in criminal and other unlawful civil behaviors to the tune of up to a couple or more $1 billion a year in recent years, and almost $1 billion a year average over the last 20 years has increased considerably. To read that a vaccine was pulled in India in part because of unethical marketing practices is appalling to me as a citizen and potential consumer of medicine and medical products and services, but as an attorney, an individual who has done at least some research on the subject, it's really par for the course, much more than it is or typical than it is something unusual in an isolated instance. And that is the frequency and magnitude of pharmaceutical criminal and civil fines is something that should give great pause to any of us who are, in fact, or potentially consumers of medical products and services.
We might also just tick off a couple more of her points, because they're all really excellent. That in February 2011, the FDA denied approval of the HPV vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine, for women over the age of 27 because of the efficacy of the vaccine that had not been studied in this age group. And as I was saying earlier, a lot of times drugs go to market and they have not been tested in the particular either age or female or male or a specific cultural type to see what the long-term effects, even short-term effects, might be. That's one of the things that's done. However, it says that the efficacy and safety of the HPV vaccine was not studied in females under the age of 15. That's also interesting. So we're giving these vaccines to age ranges that we don't know what effects that they will have because people develop differently. And as I said earlier, it was discovered that if you'd already have the antibodies to this virus or you have been previously exposed due to sexual activity, the likelihood of a risk now of contracting the disease or getting cancer is higher when you then add on top of that the Gardasil vaccine. Another point that she made is how the HPV vaccine was fast-tracked and approved to the FDA in 6 months due to heavy lobbying and intense pressure by the pharmaceutical company Merck. So there again, you have hammered away at it almost at every show about the powerful pharmaceutical industry and how they can manipulate the market.
And do. And this happens, of course, in other federal agencies as well, not just the FDA and CDC, although we focus on those two in particular, but there's certainly some compelling evidence to show that there is influence, if not coercion, and manipulation, and all taken together, I think, falls under the topic of corruption. But and there are, I'm convinced, from my own research and faith in humanity generally, there are many wonderful people in the FDA and CDC, federal agencies, and the pharmaceutical industry. I've had some of these people as clients in my law practice over the years. And I don't mean to slam everybody that has any connection with medicine or the pharmaceutical industry or federal agencies, but I am also convinced at the same time from my research over the years that a lot of the people in key decision-making positions are there ultimately in terms of their decisions for industry over people, even when they're in situations or positions in particular, let's say, with federal and state agencies where their purpose is to serve the people. Now, to the extent that any person and any given decision is something that the decision is being made with bad faith or in good faith with bad information, you know, that's going to vary from situation to situation. But what I see over time is a series of decisions that at best are being made with incomplete information, however well-intentioned, and that the consequences are many times quite disturbing. I don't know a single instance when a pharmaceutical CEO or high-ranking official has served time despite the recurrence over and over again of crimes and criminal fines, and sometimes not just in the millions, but tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in criminal fines. You don't get a criminal fine unless you knew what you were doing and you knew it was wrong and you did it anyway. I mean, it really is not the sort of thing that when it's a criminal fine that falls under the heading of accidental oversight.
Right. So basically, we do need to change the system. How and when and where and why? I mean, we know why it needs to be, but we making it happen, that's going to be a difficult struggle for government or the people or smaller lobby groups, those who are talking about the other side of the issue. So, we just keep repeating ourselves, and somehow somebody with power or know-how is going to have to change the system.
Well, and yes, and let me give a couple of real quick examples where people can get involved in a way that doesn't take an enormous amount of time, and these are both works in progress. But one would be to get on the email list for the Pandemic Response Project, which has a focus on vaccine legislative agenda items either supporting laws, the enactment of laws that give us more freedom of choice, or opposing laws that are seeking to take that freedom, whatever freedom we have, and restrict it or remove it. But also, and that's at pandemicresponseproject.com. You can also get there from the vaccinerights.com website. But then also the NVIC's advocacy portal. You can go to nvic.org, nvic.org, and they'll have links on the homepage to their advocacy portal where you can sign up and stay abreast or be kept abreast of vaccine legislative initiatives in your state, possibly other states as well. But I will, you know, I communicate with people in the Pandemic Response Project email list about vaccine legislative progress, and the advocacy portal is becoming, I think, the internet infrastructure for vaccine legislative issues. There is another issue I wanted to jump to, and I'm delighted that we had the time and input from this Gardasil victim's mother. She has certainly done her research well. But there's another piece of information that I wanted to call attention to today, Debbie, and this is comes to us from Dr. Paul King of the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs. Dr. King is a scientist, a researcher, a PhD, who has done just amazing work in research into mercury and its effects on the human body, and the research over many decades. He's thoroughly familiar with and an expert in mercury health issues, and regularly puts out information on the subject, and is often focused on vaccines. And he has a piece he's just put out in the last couple of days or so. The title is "Scandal Exposed in Major Study of Autism and Mercury." And this question about the relationship between vaccines and autism just does not go away. Mainstream officials, perhaps the vast majority of medical doctors, keep telling us over and over again that the possible connection between vaccines and autism has been disproved. We can put that to rest. It's been handled. It's over and done, and let's get on with our lives. Now, don't worry about autism from the vaccine. We don't know what's causing autism. We don't know why it's mushrooming, but it continues to grow. The rates grow, but it sure as heck isn't the vaccines. And the problem with that position is that more and more information over time just keeps coming up that raises the specter of a direct autism vaccine connection. And many people suspect it is the mercury in vaccines that's responsible for that. And so this particular article brings up yet another point with some compelling evidence. And one of the studies that the CDC has pointed to over the years was a 1992 study. It was a Danish study where they had pulled thimerosal, which is a preservative used in vaccines. And by the way, the so-called mercury-free vaccines that have been used in more recent years for some of the different kinds of vaccines, not all of them, but some, even mercury-free does not really mean mercury-free. What it means in reality is a lower level of mercury than prior vaccines when for any so-called mercury-free version of a vaccine. But vaccines do still have mercury in them, and some vaccines are not the lower levels of mercury, the so-called mercury-free vaccines. So right. that to me, as a citizen and an adult human being, again, not as a legal issue.
Well, yeah,
issue,
in a way, it's the wording that's used in the same types of, I don't know whether you call it false advertising or trickery or, you know, pull the wool over your head on. It says that when we go to the supermarket and we buy things that are natural, or they have a whole list of different types of words that they can use, and you have to really go in and read the definitions to understand what that means, if it's from a natural product or whether it's a safe product that doesn't say. If it's organic, what does that mean? Is it different in the different states? So when you talk about like cholesterol-free, or here we say thimerosal or mercury-free, what does that really mean? And you have to go into the fine, the tiny words and look and see what the legality is and how the government or the FDC has defined that, where they can use the words mercury-free or, you know, fat-free or whatever it is, because it's not what you think it is.
Right, but that is just really so disturbing to me. Again, just as a citizen and an adult human being, that anybody can, that we can reach a point in our society where you're allowed to use a phrase that's obvious common meaning is something different than what you're allowed to use the phrase for because of some legal technicality. Somebody has said, you know, gotten something approved to mean, for legal purposes, this phrase means this, even though anybody from a common sense point of view is going to think it means something else. And that's just disturbing for me. You know, it's like I try to explain to my kids, among the many things I hope to impart to them as they're growing up, that whenever something on the comes on the TV or the internet or wherever and says, you know, this costs this much and we'll do this part for free, you know, free shipping. Well, no, it's not free shipping. You're paying for the shipping. They're just, you know, categorizing it as free because they've included their cost in the price of whatever the item is you're purchasing. And this kind of thing, to me, just as a general principle, is something that we really should not tolerate in a free and open society that ours wishes it could be, and thinks sometimes mistakenly that it is. When you can say something that does not mean what its common sense meaning is, it ought to be considered, for legal purposes, deceptive. But that's not the case here. But anyway, I mentioned a 1992 study. Excuse me, it was a study published in Pediatrics in 2003. The 1992 reference was a time when the mercury preservative thimerosal was removed from certain vaccines administered in Denmark. And there's this well-publicized Danish study in Pediatrics in 2003 that claimed that autism rates actually increased after thimerosal was phased out, as though to say thimerosal was actually a preventive, potentially, of autism, but certainly in any event not a cause, because we took out the mercury and lo and behold, autism rates increased. Well, and this is a study that the CDC, among others, have pointed to say, look, there's no connection between vaccines and autism, at least not as a causative thing there. The problem was, and this is what Dr. King and Comed are pointing out here, is that, and they got an email through the Freedom of Information Act, where one of the co-authors alerted CDC officials in a 2002 email, this would have been the year before the study was published in 2003, and he says, quote, attached, I send you the short and long manuscript about thimerosal and autism in Denmark. I need to tell you that the figures do not include the latest data from 2001, but the incidence and prevalence are still decreasing in 2001. In other words, there was a body of data showing that autism decreased in Denmark after the removal of thimerosal, and they decided to conveniently leave that out and draw their conclusion as that that autism rates increased after they took thimerosal out of the vaccines. And they know that the author's lead article was aware of the missing autism data because he responded to that email with a reply email saying, you know, I'm not currently at the university or whatever it was, I'm somewhere else. But anyway, he responded to this showing that he had actually received the email. So
Which means conveniently missing information, which I consider a half truth, because you're not getting full disclosure. And this is probably happens quite often, how data can be fudged, and you know, you do a close up on a graph of one cut out section and you don't see the total picture. So do you want to talk? We have about 5 minutes left to talk about either continuing this discussion or moving to any of the other items on your list, like the one about the police who arrested the 12-year-old boy, which I find really frightening.
Yes, and of course the problems with stories like that. This was a boy who had refused, I believe it was in Canada, had refused a hepatitis B vaccine at the school, if I'm correct, and my computer just did something rather disturbing. It has gone blank on both screens, and I'm seeing none of my notes and information, Debbie, so I'm going to wing it with you for the last couple of minutes
here. I can hear you very well. So,
okay.
So this is a story coming out of, it was written by Christina England from VaccineTruth.com, and the 12-year-old was charged with threatening behavior at his school in Bowmanville, east of Toronto. This was a 2010 article. Did we know that for some reason it was reprinted in 2011? So maybe it is old news, but still it is an interesting case because they're making some kind of a connection with the fact that the police came in to the public school where he was and were going to convict him or take him away for threatening to damage the school, where my point of view is he was throwing a tantrum because he was refusing a vaccine in the school. And, you know, you would think that he would have a right to be able to do that. And in my feeling, and I don't know the outcome of this case, but if he was being threatened with harm to his own body or he didn't want something, that I could understand how he could easily want to have an automatic response, as any child might have. So, I mean, he was only 12 years old at the time. That was 2010. And, you know, do we know what the outcome of this case was?
And I don't have information on that. And the you know, a problem inherent to these kinds of news reports that involve schools or parents is we often don't see the full set of information, or both or all sides of the stories. We don't really know why he was opposed to it and what these specific behaviors were. But it raises a lot of questions, to be sure. You know, why are they giving a vaccine at school at all? Why the Hep B vaccine to a 12-year-old? Why, if you know, unless he was a severely disturbed child to begin with, what was going on that caused him to have a severe reaction in terms of his behavior to the suggestion, or you know, what were the details? We just don't know. But it bothers me that schools would be involved in the administration of vaccines at all, because that raises questions we've talked about in the past about, do you need parental consent? And if you don't, that raises a number of constitutional and other legal questions, and in the U.S. anyway, it would. I don't know about Canada, but many, many different questions underneath the surface of that kind of a story. If we have, I wanted to make a real quick mention of one other thing, because I know we're probably down to the last few seconds here, but this is an article also from Canada, but talking about the World Health Organization. There has been an effort in recent months to try and organize to have an international ban on thimerosal as a mercury-based preservative. And the World Health Organization now is trying to prevent thimerosal from being banned. There's, you know, researchers around the world who are saying mercury is not good for you. It needs to be out of medications altogether. And it has been used in a number of different medications, not just in vaccines. I think less so and less so over the years. And I think eventually we're going to see mercury amalgam fillings, you know, go by the wayside. You know, it's illegal to put a mercury filling out in your backyard. You'll be violating EPA regulations, but you can stick it in your mouth and it's okay. That's just sort of strange. But the World Health Organization is adamantly opposing banning thimerosal, and in particular with vaccines, because they're saying that's going to affect the cost and logistics where vaccines are concerned, logistics in terms of distribution. So I just would mention that point in the article. Link to the full article is on the PandemicResponseProject.com website.
Okay, very good. Okay, do you just want to mention to folks about your ebook? And I guess we'll pick up on the news next week on Thursday at 12 o'clock about other kinds of things that are going on in the different states of the in all of our states. Something's happening that we don't really know unless you go to the NVIC.org. But there are specific high-profile items that are happening. So go ahead and tell us about your e-guide, and then we're going to move on to the next show.
Great. Well, as always, thanks for all your work on the show and the privilege to be here and be part of that. The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, an e-book, is available from homeopathyworldcommunity.com. Provides the information that you need to understand about vaccine exemption and waiver law in the United States in a wide variety of different contexts so that you can make informed decisions about how to approach exercising your right to vaccine legal exemptions and waivers in a way that you're most likely to be successful. It's not the kind of situation many times where you can afford to make a mistake up front. You need to really approach it right the first time. Debbie, I look forward to seeing you next week. Do we have Greg? We have Greg with us next week. Greg Glazer, our first Thursday of the month under our normal schedule, which occasionally we have variations on, but first Thursday of the month, attorney Greg Glazer from California, constitutional law expert on a lot of these issues. So we may have him with us next week.
Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to close with our song. It's your song. And listen to Alan. He's a great lyricist and composer.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brodrock. On Homeopathy World Community Radio, remember to educate before you vaccinate. Allow our souls.